And we're going.
Okay, Glenn and I were on a trip back. I don't remember where we were on our way to Jamaica. And we flew into New York, I think it was, and then we were flying out of New York. And we were on a Delta flight. We were talking to the stewardesses on that flight and watched the passengers they had on. I would have taken a whole load of my drunken fishermen as to some of those businessmen. They were awful. They were just awful. And another thing, as far as passengers go, I had one flight with all women going to a women's club convention or something or other in Juneau. And I'd take a load of drunken fishermen as opposed to a bunch of women like that, too, because each one was trying to outdo the other and get more service than the other one. We were... Oh, that was not fun, that flight. But our passengers in Alaska were always great. I mean, pretty much like, except for this guy that wanted to be a legislator and a few times like that. Well, and the fellow going into Cordova, but he just didn't realize. And I said, I told him afterwards, you know, that's okay. I was there and he was venting. He had to vent to somebody and whoever's in front of you with the airline. That reminds me of speaking at Cordova. We had a mechanical. We landed in Cordova, and I think it was either Cordova or Yucatan. I can't remember. I think it was Cordova. But anyway, we had to wait for a part to come down from Anchorage so they could fix the plane before we could take off. And so they had Quonset huts there on the runway. And they had housed people who were working on the runway, I guess, or something there. And we found a freezer with meat in it, and we found one of those little disc phonograph players. And it was either the captain or the co-pilot, and I got out the ham, and they had a ham in there, and we thawed it out, fried it, and made sandwiches for everybody because we found bread and everything too. So we fed the passengers, and then we got started playing penny ante poker. And it was really high stakes because I was the biggest loser and I lost 38 cents. Anyway, we were just playing for pennies. It was no big deal. Everybody had a good time and we listened to the records and everything. And then we got back into Anchorage and this big old guy, was one of our passengers quite often, and he was kind of the instigator of the penny ante poker, and he was standing there talking to me, saying that what a great flight it was, how much fun they had, and this man came up to me and said that he was going to report me for gambling. Well, he was about half the size of this fellow that I was talking to. Big fellow turned on him and said, "You better not do that. You just better not do that." So I didn't get turned in for gambling. That was good. So what did I do in villages and towns? I, that one,
getting covered up by your shirt. There you go.
That one charter flight we had up to Nome and all these other places, we were able to go out and see the village and had time to, because usually on the charter we were there and then they did what they were doing and we could go off and, excuse me, we went beachcombing and so on and got to meet a lot of the people and they, one of the, well, there were several people in, I think it was Kotzebue, came up to this woman, and I can't remember what her name was. But anyway, she lived in Kodiak, and they owned a bar in Kodiak, plus Nome. And but they knew her, and they brought all kinds of carvings, hand carvings and so on, that they had done. And so we were able to, she ended up buying several pieces from each one of them. And that was really, really neat that she was, she knew all the people as well as she did. But, so that was a good trip. That was a really fun trip.
What were your impressions of Kotzebue?
Well, it was, it was on the water, you know, I mean, in the, it was just what I had pictured a village to be because I'd seen a lot of pictures of them, you know, and the houses are not pretty. The, everything's utilitarian and there's quite a bit of debris around because they have things that don't work anymore, so they end up, you know, outside the house. yeah, it's, but the people were really nice too, all of the villagers and so on.
That's, what villages did you fly into besides Kotzebue, Nome, King Salmon?
Unalakleet. Red Devil. Now, the Red Devil and Big Mountain, well, we ended up going into Big Mountain quite often, but Red Devil, Flat, those were just one or two times that I did. Flat was, ugh, talk about mosquitoes. When we were there, we landed, and the fellow that met the plane was telling me that the mosquitoes were so bad they were killing the moose. And I said, how are they killing the moose? And he said, they only breathe through their nose and their nose would get clogged up and they'd suffocate. So that's how bad bugs were at Flat. So I always remember Flat. But, and when we would fly into Red Devil, and that was one of the, or Big Mountain, that was one of the stations for the Dew Line when they had it during the war. And it was still operating and so on. And the baker, or the chef, but he was the baker, he would find out when I was coming in and he'd bring me down a big batch of, he bought me a pie one time and a bunch of cookies and my pilot at the time got really upset and said that he should have them and not me. And the baker said, well, then I'm not going to bring any more. So I shared with the pilot. He wanted the whole thing. So, but we used to get goodies every time we went out to Big Mountain. That was nice. I'd forgotten about that. That was, he's a nice old guy. Well, and then, like I said, in Antioch, I got to go she fishing. Mm-hmm. That was fun. Oh, and then we left. We had a mechanical, and we were at Gustavus, which is done by Juno. And so we were going to have to we were going to have to stay overnight. And so my captain was Joe Stevens, who was our chief pilot at the time, and he knew people that had a boat. So we got this boat, and he said, let's go out fishing, because we had a lot of time and nothing to do. And so he gave me a pair of his, he always carried this little bag where he had extra clothes in it. And he was about two people compared to me. I mean, I was two people compared to him, let's put it that way. Anyway, so he gave me his pants to wear, and we found a rope, and I tied it around so I wouldn't have to wear my uniform. And we were out fishing, and we were having so much fun, and the co-pilot got a fish on, stepped back, and the hatch was open. He fell down in the hatch. We started laughing. It was things like that that we were able to do when we would have layovers or, you know, mechanical somewhere. And you just made do with what you could, you know, had time for or what was available.
How often did mechanicals happen? Was it common or fairly infrequent?
No, not really. Not really. It was... No, usually it was something that wasn't any huge big deal or anything, you know. It was, I don't know what the deal was on that one, but another time we landed at Gustavus and we had I don't think it was the DC-3, but anyway, because there were two of us on, two girls. So, but we were going to be there for quite a little while. And so they sent somebody into town and got all the makings for sandwiches and so on and came back and we made sandwiches for everybody.
So the passengers were pretty adaptable to these situations?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you might have one or two that were not too happy, but usually it was not the way things were, you know, and you'd rather have a mechanical on the ground than trying to take off and, you know, when you weren't fixed. So they were pretty good about that. Pretty good about that. Yeah. Yeah. What did I dislike? I don't know what I disliked. Everything was an adventure for me, kind of. You know, it was because you were always meeting new people, and it was a good time. Good time.
Maybe describe life in Anchorage at the time.
Well, as far as I was concerned, I think at the time the average age was 26 and single. And my brother was there, and so I knew all the people at the fire department and through him. And then all of us that were flying the, you know, the pilots and the stewardesses and dispatchers and so on. I mean, oftentimes after a flight, we would stop at the Buckaroo or what was the other one? Can't remember. Oh, and this this girl that was the Bob Reeves chief stewardess, she was a good-sized woman. She was a beautiful girl, but she was pretty good size, and as far as being tall and big boned and so on, she wasn't fat or anything, but and she was one of them who would stop at the, it was either the Buckaroo or the, and I can't remember the name of the other one, but anyway, they were right close together in Spinard there, and she had a decided she liked the bartender. And so she wanted him to dance with her. And he said, I can't dance because I'm bartending bar. And so she leaned over the bar and grabbed him by the lapels and pulled him. He danced with her. And then she drove this little Volkswagen Beetle, and so a bunch of them from the bar went out and picked it up and and hefted it up onto the sidewalk or up beside the, so she had a terrible time getting it out of there. They were always playing jokes like that, and it was. And then I was really fortunate because my brother was with the Fish and Wildlife, and they would call, and he was a stream guard at that time. And so he was out on the streams, wherever, and they would call and say, we need a stewardess. We're going to go out and see your brother, or we're going to go pick up things or something from the stream guards and so on. So I would get, I had two big thermoses, and I'd fill those with coffee, and then I'd stop and get donuts, and then they would bring well, we called it squaw candy, and you know what that is?
No.
It's smoked fish, you know. They dry it and smoke it like the native do. Mm-hmm. And they would bring squaw candy and cheese and crackers. And away we'd go. And I got to fly all over in the Grumman Goose and with the Fish and Wildlife, going out to Soldotna. And well, we flew all over the place because it was an amphibian and we could go. And one of the stream guards and his wife were back out of Seldovia, back in there. And our pilot got it with the Fish and Wildlife. He, I remember him going, got the goose up on the step and then just ran it around on the stream like a boat. And we went way back in, and it was foggy and everything. Got back in there, and here they were. They were doing some, it was something about the crab they were studying. I don't remember exactly what it was now, but anyway. So I got to do all kinds of things like that, too, fly around with the Fish and Wildlife.
So how often did that happen?
Oh, maybe a couple times a month.
For several years or for?
Oh, yeah, 3 or 4 years. Yeah.
So. Where else did they take you?
Huh?
Where else did they take you?
Well, it was, we'd go to Kenai, we would go to wherever, been to Homer, Soldotna, back in the bush there, and oh, and then one of the fellows with the Fish and Wildlife called me. He had bought himself, oh God, I can see, what do they call it? It's like a push me, pull you. I can't think of the name of the plane right now. It's on the tip of my tongue. But anyway, he said, I'm going to go get Janet, I think her name was, his girlfriend anyway. And he said, then we'll go up to Big Lake and get Dick and go down to Soldotna. I had it right there. I can see it. Anyway, I said, okay. Well, it's an amphibious too. And it's got the prop behind the cockpit, sort of. What do they call that? Anyway, so we were flying. We went up and got Dick. Well, by with the four of us in it, it was really weighted down. And he had to go the full length of Big Lake in order to get off. And we finally went down to Soldotna, had a ball, and my brother knew the fellow who was the postmaster, the mayor, the you name it, he was Mr. Soldotna. And he had, we had lunch there, and he showed us around town and stuff. And we went to take off. And we were going, and we were going, and we were going. He couldn't get off. This huge, big seaweed had got caught in the wing, in the wheel, you know, where the, when you're going on water, you pull the wheels up, and when they pulled the wheels up, it pulled this big piece of seaweed up too, I guess, or something. And we finally got up and barely got off and then got rid of the seaweed, but we didn't know where we were going to get off there for a while. That was a lot of fun. That was, anyway, I got back, and my next flight, one of my pilots said, what did you do over the weekend or, you know, while you were off? And I said, oh, I went flying, and if I could think of the name of this plane. He said, don't you ever let me hear that you've been flying in one of those. It has a glide ankle like a footlocker. So, but I did. I still flew in it with Dusty. He was, yeah. And too many things. It was, that time in Alaska, like I say, you didn't have to block your door. And it was, it was really neat. You know, I mean, there was it was a very small town in comparison to what it is now. It was.
So when did you meet your husband?
Well, I met him, like I said, everybody at the Spinard Fire Department was like a big brother to me. And so I had one of the fellows was dating a girlfriend of mine, Janet, and so I stopped in. I was looking for her, and the only person in there was somebody I had never seen before, but he was sitting with his feet up reading newspaper. And he looked up at me, and I said, do you know where Nick is? Because that was the guy I was looking for, trying to find Janet. And he said, oh, I think he's at the bowling alley. And I said, oh, okay. And I turned around and started to leave. Well, I had heard that Dick had been there or something. I don't remember. And I turned around and I said, oh, you must be Dick. And he went, oh, well, you must be Ellen. But how I knew about him was his brother Chuck worked at P&A at the ticket counter. And I was on my way in for a flight one morning, and he came running out, and I had 1 foot on the stairs to go up to dispatch. And he said, "Ellen, Ellen, my little brother's coming." I thought, big deal. I'm late for my flight. So that was my first, when I first heard about Dick. And then after that, Glenn and I, most of the guys from the fire department and everything, they'd stop by at where Glenn and I were living. We had a basement apartment in a friend of mine's house. And we, they just gathered there. So we had we had moved in, hadn't been there too long, and decided we were going to have an open house. And so you just set the word, and word traveled, and we had between 70, 75 people there. And there were only four of them we didn't know, and they ended up being really close friends. And Dick was one. He was invited from the fire department, and we had put everybody's coats in our bedroom, and I went in to get something, and here he was lying on his back reading a book. I said, "What are you doing in here?" "Reading a book." I said, "The party's out there." And I didn't know him that well at all. And I don't know. Then it was around Christmas time, and I was going to get myself a pair of skis, new skis. I had bought the leftovers of, this girlfriend of mine bought this whole set, the boots, the skis, the everything. And the boots didn't fit me, but she sold me the skis and the poles and everything. But they were the real short skis. They were short skis. And then at that time, everybody thought you had to have these tremendously long skis, which were... So I was doing pretty good on those, but there were wood, and the new skis were just coming out. And so I thought, I'm going to get myself a new pair of skis for Christmas. Well, Dick told me then, he found out about it, and he said, "Well, you don't know anything about skis. I'm going to have to go and pick them out for you." Well, then I ended up doing his Christmas shopping, and I don't know, one thing just led to another. But that's the way it was, you know. I mean, with everybody just got together and had a good time. Mm-hmm. We would go skiing and then come back down, and the bars in town would have food out. So we would come to the bar, their bar, and buy their booze, you know. And so that was always a lot of fun, too. And we would dance. And then one of the fellows that was on the ski patrol with Dick, it was the Army, and they were both on the ski patrol for the Army. And he was from Hungary. And his name was Ed Samé, and he had this terrible, terrible accent. And he ended up marrying a girl from Arkansas who had a terrible accent. I couldn't be around them an hour and my cheeks would hurt. I mean, they were just so funny. But he was a wonderful dancer. He did the schottische and the polkas and all that kind of stuff. So I got to dance with him all the time doing those. That was fun. So it was Very happy time. Very happy time.
And you said you and Dick went out for 6 years before you got married?
Yeah, well, that's when I first met him. And then he asked me out. And then we went to a movie and dinner and a movie. And then he just seemed to always be around. And then he had some friends who lived in Europe. And so he went over and ordered a bunch of, that's when the stretch ski pants were just coming out, and they weren't really here in the U.S. yet. So he ordered a bunch of stretch ski pants, what they call walkie anchors, the jackets, and some three-link coats, and then came back and we sold those to the Caribou store. It used to be over there where Sears is now. And then also he sold ski boots to the military. So, and we used my garage. I had a house at that time. No. Oliver. Anyway, I'd had enough. He said, get your ski pants and stuff. Well, we were sort of in business together, you know, so but I said I wanted to get out of it. And so he made some excuse, and it was all over again. Here we were. He brought his mother and his sister-in-law and everything. Finally, I said, okay. It was about 6 years. And we've been going, doing everything together. I mean, going out together and stuff. And I said, I've had enough. I just got myself a one-way ticket to Copenhagen. He said, what are you going to do in Copenhagen? I said, I don't know. I'll get a job or do something. I said, I'm sure I can find something. And why are you going to Copenhagen? I said, well, I don't want to, if we're going to break up, I don't want to be around here, and we're going nowhere, so I'm out of here. It was about a week later, I had a ring. I still have the ticket, and it wasn't one way, it was round trip. But I had a pass. I could get a pass, but it still cost me $93, so. That's what it took to get him broken loose.
So you were there during the statehood push, and you knew a lot of the politicians.
Yes.
So what were your observations at the time?
What?
What were your observations at the time?
Oh, well, the preparation up to the big celebration was going on, and there was all kinds of excitement and so on. And I had a trip that day, and they had this huge, big bunch of wood down out on the park strip. And they had a huge, big bonfire. And I had flown to Kenai. My last flight was to Kenai. I was coming back, and we could see the flames from the airplane as we were coming in for a landing. Well, and we quickly went home, got home and changed clothes. And the place to go at the time was the 515. And So I talked to people, I mean, all kinds of people, hundreds of people, I think. And, well, where were you during the bonfire? During, I was at the 515. So was I. There, it was, you couldn't move. There were so many people in there, you just couldn't, you couldn't move. It
Now, is
was,
this the first day of statehood, or is this the
that's the
announcement?
celebration they had, yeah.
Okay. On the day that they
I
became a
think it
state, or
was on the
okay.
day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in the run up to it, when they were trying to get it accomplished, were you at that time, were you still meeting the politicians on the air? Were you,
Oh, yeah.
and what were your observations there?
Well, everybody was excited about it that I talked to, you know, and it was, we were just waiting to see what was going to happen. And, but it was, yeah, it was exciting. It was, and then we were a state finally, because we'd been a territory up until that time, and now we could vote and do all kinds of things.
Did that affect your workplace at all, the switchover?
No. No. You know what we used to do too when I was first flying is, we'd fly into Anchorage, and then when we come back down into Seattle, we had to go through customs. And we don't have to do that, and that's it. We didn't even stop in Canada, but we still had to go through customs because we flew over Canada. Yeah.
So, looking back on the stewardess years, what's your overall assessment of it? You've said repeatedly that it was really fun, and I mean, do you just feel like that's the best choice you could have made?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I always, for a long time, I felt, well, because I hadn't gone to college, there are certain people that always throw that at you that, well, you didn't go to college, you know, and so you don't know anything and so on. And I always kind of blame my mother because she was the one that said I just absolutely could not go to college. And although my, advisor at in high school and the even the principal and vice principal were they who would have gotten me scholarships and everything, but my mom said no, that we couldn't afford to do that, that I had to, you know, and I always resented her for that for a long time. Sort of, you know, I mean, thinking, well, if there were ways that I could have gotten to college. But then I thought after one day I had an epiphany and I thought, if I'd gone to college, I would not have done everything. My life would have been so different and I wouldn't trade my life, my years as a stewardess for anything. You know?
Yeah.
And I don't think it made me that uneducated.
What was your family's reaction when you told them you were moving to Alaska?
When I was,
When you told them you were moving to Alaska, your mom and your siblings, how did they respond?
well, it was supposed to be temporary right at first, so, and that was just part of the deal. My mother had a hard time for me moving to Seattle to start flying because I was living in Spokane and earn opportunity and, she had a really hard time with that. My sister-in-law told me that she didn't change the calendar for 2 or 3 years from the day I left. And so that was hard on her because I was the last of six and everybody else was all off and married and so on. And I think she thought I was going to be there forever. But, as far as my brother and everything, he was the instigator. He was the one that told him that told me that PNA was hiring, and so yeah, And and everybody knew that I always wanted to travel, so mm-hmm. that was good.
It seems like taking off on an adventure at that time as a young single woman would have been less common than today. And so how did you think about that at the time? Or did you just go?
No, I didn't. Not really. Mm-mm. No, I was off to do my dream job, really. Because mm-hmm. I had read a lot of stories on girls who had were flying, you know, that with other airlines, but the big airlines. And see, at that time, you could go to the airline school and so on. And but one of the things I did do before, and not many people know this, is Morrison Knudsen, isn't that the big construction company, was doing a big job in Buenos Aires. And I went down and checked to see what openings they had in case, but I kind of chickened out on that one. I was going to apply for something to go to, I can't think of the name of the place in Buenos Aires it was, but anyway. But I thought about doing that. I just wanted to go. I wanted to get out, have adventures.
The training school, you said you went 4 weeks there. What did they teach you there?
Well, you had to learn the all of the emergency things on the airplane and everything, and then you had to do ditching, which was... We went out to the Sandpoint Naval Base, I guess it was. They had a big pool, and they had a... You had to slide down like they do on the big slides they have that go down into the water. You had your life vest on and everything, and then you had to swim over and crawl into this inflated little boat thing. Well, if you got the life vest on, you got your clothes on, and you're in the water, and you're trying to get up over the side of this. So finally, somebody had grabbed me and pulled me in. I did get in. But yeah, we had to do that. We had to learn first aid. We had to take first aid classes. And learning how to cope with the passengers and so on.
And coping with the passengers, what were they teaching you there?
Well, I mean, being your cabin hospitality and, you know, and things like that, just being kind of a hostess on the airplane is what it was.
How'd you like flying in and out of Juneau? That's a pretty... exciting.
Oh, that was great. That was great because we, when we have a chance to go into town or, you know, and stay over and once in a while, but it was the real old, what you read about Alaska being, because they had the, what saloon was that? Red Dog Saloon. And they had this lady there that played the piano, and she wore white gloves. And she was, you know, the old piano player like they used to, and like you saw in the old movies. And the Baranov Hotel had gorgeous paintings of the Alaskan artists. And can't think of the name of them now. Mokotan's, I don't think, wasn't there then, but there's anyway, I have a couple of the prints, but they had some gorgeous paintings and so on, and it was old-timey too, and it was great. As far as towns are concerned, the Cordova had this hotel that we stayed in when we had to stay overnight, and you had to have a map to find your room. I mean, there were, I don't know how many rooms were in that hotel. It was, and you go down this hall, down that hall, and then back this way until you finally got to your room, which was wonderful and nice. And they had a big old clawed tub, you know, and that sat right in the middle of kind of a room off of the bedroom. The only problem was it took about 3 tub loads of cold water to finally get the warm water out there where you were. I learned my lesson the first time, and I don't think I tried to manage the second. I was only there a couple of times, but it was fun.
What place did you like flying into the most, if you were to pick?
I don't know. It was beautiful going into Homer because of the fireweed on the side of the hill at certain times of the year. That was a beautiful place to fly into. That was really pretty. I don't know, each had its own. Going to Juneau was like going to a bigger city, which was nice too, new. But probably the flights are so short to Kenai and Homer, and well, in Kodiak too, but that you ended up having to take a couple a day. And so it's usually more fun to go to someplace far away, like Juneau.
How many days a week did you fly?
Well, I'm trying to think. Probably there were restrictions on how much you could fly. Like you had to have a certain amount of rest time and so on before you could take another flight after you'd been so many hours on. And I can't remember what the ratio was now, but so I'd say we flew at least maybe 4 times a week. So. But then we could be on a flight, you know, and be weathered in or something like that. And it would be so many hours on. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Dick and I have been married for 2 years. No, a year. Just about a year. And he had gone to Kodiak because he was working with the city of Kodiak and as a manager, what do you, I can't think what you call him now. But anyway, he had just come back, and I was 7 months pregnant, and so he came back, and he was so tired he wanted to take a nap. So I thought, well, if he's going to take a nap, I'll lie down too. And I lay down on a couch, had a long coffee table in front of the couch, and all of a sudden, it started happening, and everything was shaking and so on. And I tried to get up off of the couch, and he came out of the bedroom when we had a split level, and he was standing right in front of the stairway, and I crawled over and was grabbed onto his leg, and the petition that was behind us was just galloping. And we could hear in the kitchen, and it was a galley kitchen behind. The refrigerator opened, everything was going out, and it was back and forth. I mean, everything was going out of the, we could hear banging and crashing, and we had a console TV that fell over. Pictures on the walls were flying off. And he kept my head down because he didn't want me to look outside, because we had one tree right out in front of our picture window in the living room, and it was flipping, hitting the ground on either side. It was flipping back and forth. And it finally stopped, and we went into the kitchen, and it was knee-deep in dishes and pots and things out of the refrigerator and everything out of the cupboards and so on. And so we started picking up and cleaning up, and we found 2 cups, no chips, 2 saucers, no chips, 2 plates, no chips, 2 glasses, no chips, but everything else was smithereens. And if that doesn't make the hair in the back of your head stand. Anyway, and then it was, they were bringing people in from Old Harbor, and Sven Hawkinson was the chief of Old Harbor at the time. And he'd been in the military with Dick, and they were good friends. And they were bringing, Sven saw all the water going out of the bay, and he knew that it had to come back in again. So he got all of his people up on high ground, and so nobody was lost or hurt in Old Harbor, but anyway, they brought those people in and were housing them in one of the high school or grade schools in Anchorage. And so Dick heard that that's what they were doing. So he went over to the school and he found Sven and his wife and 2 little ones and Kahutek. I don't know what his first name was. Kahutek, who is this little Native guy who Dick said, well, he was short, and Dick said his rifle was taller than he was. He was in the army with him, too. But he and his wife. And so he brought him home. And because we had our electricity and everything back, and we were bringing people in, I just kept pot roast going all the time. And I just keep adding to the pot roasts, and people would come and so they could take showers and so on. But I was in the kitchen working on the pot roast. Oh, excuse me. So we'd gone into Kenai, and we didn't have any passengers coming back to Anchorage, and so Red is gone now. So, and I don't know who the co-pilot was, but Red can't get in trouble. So anyway, he said, "You want to take it off?" And I said, "Sure." So he set me in the pilot seat, in the captain seat, And then he stood behind me and Locke told me what to do and everything, and I took off the... We took off in the DC-3.
And how'd that feel?
That was really hard. I mean, because you had to... You needed a lot of weight. I mean, pulling and making sure that... And I was so afraid I was going to go sideways or whatever. But, and there was no... I mean, everything was okay because the co-pilot was there at the controls. He could have taken over if he needed to and so on and so on. But he did it.
But you pulled it off.
Yeah, yeah. I did. Yeah.
So we were...
Oh, you were...
We were boiling pot roast.
Huh?
We were cooking pot roast.
Oh, yes. And we had the... Give the... Sven's wife was in the bathroom giving the kids baths, and Kahutek's wife came into the kitchen, and I have this at home, but she had in her hand this little basket, and it had a kind of a list to it, and it was had been wet, and some of the colors had run a little bit. And she apologized for the basket. But it was the only thing that she salvaged from Old Harbor. And it had been in the corner of one of her sleeping bag is how she found it. And that was her only possession, and she insisted that I have it because as a thank you. I get teary-eyed every time I think about it. I mean, so I still have that basket, and it's very precious. So
how long did it take for the gravity of the earthquake to, I mean, for how powerful it had been? How long was it before you knew how bad Anchorage was damaged?
Well, it seemed like it lasted forever, because it was several minutes. I think it was... Wasn't it 4 minutes, something like that? I don't know, but it seemed like it lasted forever. And afterwards, we found out that friends of ours that lived out at where they have the earthquake park, what do they call that area now? Anyway, their house, she and her two kids were in their rec room, and they had just put some music on. They had a console record player, and her husband was coming home from the airport, and he said that the road was just like somebody shaking a blanket. You know how it ripples? And by the time he got home, they had been in the rec room. The house slid. Luckily, none of them were hurt, but it slid down, and they had to crawl up the floor to get out of their house. And we had other friends that lived out there, and... he was a neurosurgeon, I think it was. He was at the hospital, and the kids were out playing, and the earth just opened up and then clapped them, and they were gone. I don't think they ever did find them. They were, so it was pretty devastating, really, but considering... Had it been any other time of day, had it been maybe any other day, the kids were not in school. The people who were working, they were building this big building down by the old Providence Hospital. And the superintendent had just, supervisor, whatever he was, had just made a sweep of the building to make sure everybody was out because they were all going to go home. And that completely collapsed. The only thing left standing was the chimney, I think it was. And, but it was, we were very, very fortunate. We had a little, couple of little cracks in our foundation. And my husband had just, when we bought the house, the basement wasn't finished. And he was not one that liked to do stuff. But we were making an office for him down in the basement. And he'd put up that ceiling tile that had the glue on each corner and looked gorgeous. It was, that all fell down. He just had it up. He just gotten it up. That fell down. But other than that, I mean, we had no damage or anything. Which is
where were you at in the city?
We lived in Rogers Park. Okay. Yeah, our house is still there. And it was after that we moved over to College Village then, to another house. And, but yeah, we were really fortunate. And we had to tell people when they came to bring either paper plates or something. We only had two. Two of everything is all we had. It was unreal.
So how did Anchorage change over the 60s and into the 70s?
Well, I hate to say this because my daughter now is married to a fellow who works with BP. But when I noticed the biggest change was when the oil people started coming up. It started changing because before that, we had the Women's Club, which was a lot of fun. We did a lot of things for the community and so on, you know. And then we had the Treasures of Sight and Sound, and that was started by Betty Cuddy, who it was putting on plays with children. Children's stories and getting them into acting and so on. That was great. What else did we have? But I mean, it was just small town, you know. I mean, it wasn't. Well, the BP or not BP, but the oil wives. Then they had the. Of course, they had to have the oil. What's that special group? Petroleum Club. They had the Petroleum Club. That was it. That was a big thing. And then they had, they were appalled that we didn't have a junior league. And so, from what I understand, you have to have an entity like Treasures of Sight and Sound or something like that, and then that would... they could take it over and become the junior league. Betty Cuddy said, absolutely not. And but, I mean, that's when things started, as far as I was concerned, started changing. Because before that, we were, like I say, it was everybody got together and had a good time. And I would get a call sometime from a friend of mine who was a pilot, and I had a little house out in Spinard, and he'd call up and say, get the hibachi out, I'm coming in with a fresh salmon. So I get on the phone and call everybody and put it out in the lawn. We had they were just those little hibachi things, you know, not fancy barbecues or anything at all, and get charcoal going and everything, and he'd come in with a fresh salmon, and we'd have a salmon feed. you know, things like that. And then it got to be, well, if you had somebody over for dinner, then you had to have a better centerpiece than the guy that had the dinner before and all that kind of thing. And so when we moved down to Vashon, I told my husband, I said, I don't even want a dining room table for a while. We're going to barbecue, which we did.
What prompted your leaving Alaska?
Oh, my husband, I don't know if you'd call it a midlife crisis, but he got involved with this fellow who had a seafood company. And so he quit the brokerage business and bought into the seafood company and we came down to, so he could help run it down here. And that's how we, and he would come down and we came down, I don't know how many times, to look at houses and things. So we looked over on Bainbridge and never found anything there, and absolutely didn't want anything over at Mercer Island, but he wanted to be in the water. And one, he had meetings on Friday and Monday. And so over the weekend, he rented a car, and I don't know where he went over. Oh, I know, he was going to go over to Gig Harbor to see what that was like. Because everybody had been telling us, oh, you don't want to go to Vashon. I mean, oof, not to Vashon. And so he went back to Seattle via Vashon, came in on the south end and went off the north end. And while he was there, here, he looked at several places and found our house on Quartermaster. And he went back home, and he said, I want you to go down. I don't want you to talk to anybody because you're going to go to Vashon. He said, rent a car and go to Vashon. And I don't know. All the houses we looked at, we walked in, and we became really good friends with the people we bought it from. But they had been doing some remodeling in the... They had linoleum floor, and there were just pieces on top of pieces around on one area. And she had gone somewhere in a hurry, and her kitchen was, I don't think you could put your finger down for, I mean, it was just a mess in there. But for some reason, and it was raining buckets. Oh, it was just really coming down. And I walked in, and I don't know what it was, but that was our house. And so...
So your later years in Anchorage, what were those like? What were you mostly tied up with child rearing, or were you doing other things?
Okay, yeah, well, we were married, and I worked with Dick for a while because he was... he had just started the brokerage house for Foster and Marshall. And then I got pregnant, and after Lisa was born, then I didn't go back to work. And then 14 months later, I had a rig. So I was pretty much tied up, but by that time we were living in... College Village, and then I got hornswoggled into joining the women's club, and I had two really good girlfriends who were wonderful at being chairman of things. And I thought, I don't want to be a chairman, so I was always their worker bee. And we put on balls. The women's club always had Christmas balls, and we'd have open houses. We would have luncheons and everything, and so they'd organize, and I'd go around and and help. But yeah, they were good times. And but I had a hard time thinking about leaving Alaska. But then once I got down here and on Vashon, I mean, I couldn't ask for a better place to be right now, this time in my life. So this is good.
So if you were to just say one thing you wanted to say to people in Alaska today, what would it be?
Oh, my goodness. Well, one thing I can say, I'm so glad I was there when we were a territory and going through all of that, because it was a different time entirely when we were a territory. And of course, things have changed all over the country. I mean, it's not just Alaska, but and Alaska's a big city now. You know, it's not our little town like it had been. But I don't know. Alaska will always have a special place in my heart, that's for sure. That is very for sure. And another thing, I doubt that we'll have any more now because so many people have passed away, but we've had PNA reunions they started after we moved down here. It was the first one, I think. And it was everybody. It was the ground crew, the pilots, the stewardesses, the mechanics, everybody. Anybody who worked with PNA. And they were great. We had Art Woodley at the first one, and he spoke, and he was madder than a hornet, too. It was really funny because they had merged, PNA merged with Western, and Western evidently reneged on a lot of the things they were supposed to have done to keep the airline. I don't know exactly what. All I know is he was really mad at Western for not doing what he thought they were supposed to do. So, and then Western merged with Delta. So, and there are still girls flying with Delta that I flew with at PNA.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So.
Well, we've been.
Now, my girlfriend Glenna, she was always joking with one of the pilots. I can't remember his name. I'll have to. But anyway, he was a big, tall, handsome guy, and when he came out of the cockpit on the DC-3, he always had his hat on because that made him look more really regal, you know, and tall. And so on the flight, the pilots would hang their coats down in the back by the galley on the DC-3, and she took a needle and thread, and she sewed his sleeves together so that when he put his arm in his sleeve, he couldn't get it through. And here he was in front of the passengers trying to be the big macho pilot, and he couldn't get his coat on. It was so funny. And the two of them after that were on each other. It was one joke after another after that. But that was the best. She really got him on that one.
All right, we're good.
Yeah, Mr. Woodley didn't believe that we should act like it was cold in Alaska, so he wouldn't allow us to wear ski pants or boots. I had friends with the that were on the Navy or the, I think it was the, what is the one, the Army in Alaska, in Anchorage? Huh? Elmendorf.
Elmendorf, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, and they gave me a slip that showed what happened with the wind chill factor. And they still wouldn't believe that there was a difference in the temperature and wind chill temperature. So, but I tried. and then what was the other one? We were
flying.
Oh, and then when we would, it's another thing that we were able to do in the DC-3s, we were going into Kodiak, and we would, on nice days, we'd fly around the Barren Islands because there were, when the seals were on, and there would be a whole bunch of seals there. And then also this same pilot had spotted a big brown bear, and he'd watch for her, and she would come out certain times a year with cubs and everything, and then she'd be gone for a while and then come back. But we always kind of checked to see if she was going to be there as we were going into Kodiak. And one trip we had this fellow on board who was with the Navy, and he was going into Kodiak, and he was having the most wonderful time on that trip and watching them, seeing the seals and looking for the bear and all this kind of stuff. And then he gets to the base and he writes a letter and said, when I get on an airplane, I want to go to point A or point B and not all this folder all in between, and got the pilot in trouble. And so we couldn't do that for a while after that. And there was one other one I was going to tell you about the wind chill, but I can't remember what it was now.